It's a bailout. It's a giveaway. It's poorly crafted. It costs the state $150 million over the next 5 years.
Lawmakers debate a bill to prop up Alaska's oil refineries. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 15th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, performance art at Ship Creek that connected to a national movement.
Love, that's the power behind it. It's a love and caring concern for one another and for this planet that we live on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Alaska legislature has passed a measure allowing out-of-state residents to serve on the board of a corporation that could play a key role in a major liquefied natural gas pipeline project. The Senate's 13-2-7 vote helped clear the way for Richard Rabinow, a former pipeline company executive from Texas, to serve on the board of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Governor Sean Parnell appointed Rabinow last September and has defended the appointment as falling within his discretion under the Constitution. Rabinow faces confirmation Thursday. Supporters of the bill, including House Speaker Mike Chenault, have said it was an oversight to not explicitly allow for out-of-state residents to serve on the board. They say they want the best people possible to serve. Opponents say Alaskans should make policy decisions for Alaskans. The Flint Hills Refinery in North Pole plans to cease operation this spring, and the Parnell administration warns PetroStar's refinery in North Pole might be next. A bill crafted by the administration would prop up Alaska's three remaining oil refineries with $150 million in state funds. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, even some legislators who are helping advance the bill say they're uncomfortable with the loose terms of the giveaway.
North Pole Republican Representative Steve Thompson says Fairbanks needs PetroStar's interior refinery, especially if it hopes to attract the new F-35 fighter units to Eielson Air Force Base.
No jet fuel? Goodbye. F-16s moved. That means Eielson's going to close. 1,500 civilian jobs. We're going to have empty houses in Fairbanks. The economy's going to tank further.
State Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash says the high price of North Slope crude makes it hard for in-state refineries to compete with fuel imported from outside. The administration originally proposed $300 million in refinery assistance, primarily to help PetroStar, which faces higher costs for crude delivery now that its neighbor, Flint Hills, won't be contributing. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says he wants the refinery to stay open, too, but he calls the bill pending in the House now insane policy.
It's a bailout. It's a giveaway. It's poorly crafted. It costs the state $150 million over the next 5 years, and it gives $50 million to Tesoro, who doesn't even want the money. At a time when we can't afford our schools, we need to come up with smarter solutions than just giving money to companies.
The bill would allow an Alaska refinery to collect $10 million a year from the state for 5 years. That would mean $20 million a year for PetroStar, which has refineries in North Pole and Valdez, and $10 million a year for Tesoro's operation in Kenai. The companies would get the money in the form of tax credits or in cash if the company doesn't owe state taxes. All the refineries would have to do is show they spent $25 million a year on infrastructure. Guerra says that's a low bar, and there are no limits on what the refinery can do with its state money.
Keep the money in profits, give the money to their executives, give the money to their shareholders. There are no sideboards.
Guerra proposed offering the refineries low-interest loans instead, but his amendment failed 8-3 in the House Finance Committee Monday. Representative Tammy Wilson, another North Pole Republican, says PetroStar is too close to the edge for loans.
Where they're at right now, they may not be here in 5 years. They're not going to get a loan for something in which the company may not be able to make it. You know, we have to do something now to make them healthy.
PetroStar is owned by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Senior Vice President Tara Sweeney at the Capitol to press for the bill says she's doing what she can not to close the refinery.
The refining industry in Alaska is not healthy. We're down here working to ensure that it is, and the tools are there that are necessary to keep us afloat.
If it does close, the state says it would lose millions of dollars a year in revenues. But lawmakers who question the refinery assistance bill point out PetroStar hasn't opened its books to them. Republican Representative Alan Osterman of Kodiak says he's troubled by the lack of information.
We're just going based upon a company come to the state of Alaska saying that we're going to go out of business if you don't give us some money.
Fairbanks Democrat David Guttenberg says the bill was dropped on them in the last days of the session with no meaningful analysis. He says he'd like not to vote for it, but Guttenberg says they're in a bind.
You know, here we are faced with this, and, you know, this is what we have. And is it the best thing? I don't think so. Is it the only thing? Yeah.
The bill has cleared the House Finance Committee, and sponsors hope to get it through both the House and Senate before the legislature adjourns this weekend. In Juneau, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The ConocoPhillips LNG plant in Nikiski may be reopening soon thanks to a boost from the federal government. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the Department of Energy announced Monday that it has approved a request from the company to resume LNG exports to Japan.
For 47 years, the liquefied natural gas plant in Nikiski sent gas exports to Japan until a shortage of gas in the Cook Inlet Basin and the expiration of its license forced ConocoPhillips to shutter the plant a year ago. Now the company says it's getting back in the export game. In a news release, spokesperson Natalie Lohman said ConocoPhillips plans to reopen the plant later this spring and resume LNG exports on a seasonal basis over the summer for the next 2 years. The announcement comes on the heels of the Federal Department of Energy giving the okay for Conoco to export to countries that are not part of a free trade agreement with the United States. That would include Japan. In February, the department approved an application for the company to ship to free trade agreement countries such as South Korea. ConocoPhillips made their application December 11th. In the application materials, the company had to prove it could meet local demand for at least 2 years. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a tale of two king runs. In Southeast, the forecast is for a strong return, but on the Yukon, it's a different story.
We're going to have trouble meeting our escapement goals, even if there is no harvest of king salmon on the Yukon River.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Earlier this month, lawmakers announced they were killing House Bill 77, saying that emotions had become so inflamed over the permitting bill that it was best left alone. But now, some of its less controversial provisions might be coming back in a different form. Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash does not undersell the heartburn that HB 77 caused. So when asked what parts of the bill he wants to revive this season, he's very clear.
We had all kinds of things that caught a lot of heat and light from the public. General permits, appeals, water provisions, temporary water uses, reservations. None of that is what we're talking about.
The Parnell administration is currently working with Representative Kathy Munoz, a Juneau Republican, to restore language provisions dealing with land exchanges and leases. The idea is to attach it to a bill that already deals with the selling of state land. The pressing argument for reviving the land exchange language is to allow a swap between a state park in the Juneau area and the adjacent landowners. Because a trail to the park and a set of popular cabins cuts across private property, a deal has been in the works for more than a decade. Balash says there was language in HB 77 that would have let that deal go through. He says the administration didn't get any negative testimony on that part of the bill. Senator Peter McKitty, a Soldotna Republican, had a number of reservations with the original bill. He says Balash is right that there are some parts of the bill that should pass and that he's open to what the administration's proposing on land exchanges, but he's not willing to touch anything that generated negative public testimony.
If they try to go into some of the other sections, then it's too late. It's too late to talk about those things this year.
For his part, Balash says the administration is willing to drop the issue if there's any pushback. The exact changes that are being considered have not become public. Balash says they could come in the form of a bill rewrite sometime this week or as an amendment to the land sale bill. Fishers on the Kuskokwim River are expecting unprecedented restrictions to bring more king salmon to spawning grounds. On the Yukon River, fishermen can expect a similar set of restrictions. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
20 years ago, king salmon runs on the Yukon averaged 300,000 fish. In 2013, biologists counted just 76,000 kings. Stephanie Schmidt is the Yukon River research biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
I think with this run size, we're going to have trouble meeting our escapement goals, even if there is no harvest of king salmon on the Yukon River.
The forecast this year is for between 64 and 121,000 kings. Managers don't expect to have any directed king openings. Still, some kings could be accidentally caught in gill nets intended for other salmon species or whitefish. Schmidt says fishers will likely not be able to use gill nets unless many more kings than expected come into the river. Using non-traditional gear is the subject of current discussions between managers and fishermen.
The idea is, can we provide opportunity to fishermen for subsistence fishing in a way that would allow them to catch all those other species, especially the abundant summer chum salmon or the fall chum salmon that come in and are supposed to have a good run this year? Are there ways that they can target those species and not harm king salmon?
One type of gear is dip nets, which allow for the live release of kings. Fishermen may also be using beach seines and fish wheels with a live chute. There's no firm fishing schedule set, but subsistence fishing will close according to law when the first pulse of king salmon enter the river. As this year's breakup approaches, Schmidt says conversations with Yukon residents have been positive.
Fishermen on the Yukon recognize the issue. They recognize that we're in a situation where we need to conserve and we need to get more fish on the spawning grounds if we're going to give this run any chance of recovering.
On the commercial side, the Alaska Board of Fish this spring tweaked the rules for commercial summer chum fishing. Non-circular dip nets can be as large as 6 feet by 3 feet. The board did not pass a proposal from the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association to allow for purse seines during times of king salmon conservation. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
King salmon are expected to be plentiful in parts of southeast Alaska this summer. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game this month announced a king salmon harvest quota allowed under the Pacific Salmon Treaty and based on the forecasts of Chinook returning to rivers and streams on the Pacific coast of the United States and Canada. Southeast's harvest quota for all fishing gear groups is 439,400 Chinook. Patty Scannis is the department's troll management biologist for Southeast.
And this is a big increase over last year. It's an increase of 263,400 fish. And the preseason troll treaty allocation is 325,411 Chinook. And this was an increase of about 196,000 when compared to last year's preseason troll allocation.
Abundance is projected for Pacific Coast stocks from Alaska to Oregon, and Scana says some of the rivers to the south are expecting better king salmon runs.
This year, the Columbia River is forecast at a record 1.6 million fall Chinook. In addition to the Columbia River forecast, West Coast Vancouver Island and Washington Coastal and North Oregon coastal stocks are also expected to come in higher than last year, and these large stock groups typically represent most of our southeast Alaska catch.
Meanwhile, King Salmon runs to the Stikine and Taku. Two transboundary rivers near Wrangell and Juneau are not forecast to have big returns this year. The higher harvest quota could mean longer openings for King Salmon trolling in the summertime. Last year, the fleet had only 1 6-day opening in July for kings. The short fishing time had the fleet spending most of its summer on a bumper crop of coho, along with hatchery chums and even some pink salmon trolling.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A Matanuska Electric Association official charges that the Anchorage Municipal Assembly is spending city funds on private interests. Joe Griffith, MEA's executive director, has contacted Anchorage officials with concerns that city money is being spent on one assemblyman's legal fight against a power station upgrade. In a letter to Anchorage Municipal Assembly Chair Ernie Hall, MEA executive director Griffith says that one assembly member, Eagle River's Bill Starr, is planning to spend city funds to fight MEA's appeal of a Municipal Planning and Zoning Commission decision. Griffith says this is clearly a misuse of public funds.
The Assembly has had no role whatsoever in this process. Now, they so far have not had to weigh in on it, so therefore they have no formal position. And yet they have chosen to fund the attorneys that are fighting MEA's request for a review of the process that refused us the right to upgrade a substation.
Griffith adds that by law, MEA must maintain its facilities to keep up with power demands. The city's Planning and Zoning Commission had earlier denied a bid by MEA for a conditional use permit for the upgrade of the power company's Justine Park substation in Eagle River. Now MEA is appealing the commission's decision to the Board of Adjustment. According to Griffith's letter, Starr has tapped the law firm of Ashburn and Mason to help him in opposing the power station upgrade. Starr would not agree to a recorded interview. He says there's no impropriety because the city maintains legal counsel for assembly members. Starr says the Board of Adjustment process is complicated and that he wants good legal advice on how the board operates. Starr says MEA wants to build the substation in a residential neighborhood and that the residents have a right to complain. Some residents in Haines are pursuing the dream of a railroad that may one day link the community to interior Alaska, Yukon Mines, and to a future port facility. As Margaret Friedenauer of Station KHNS reports, the state and other stakeholders aren't dismissing the idea outright.
It's not likely a railroad is going to come to Haines anytime soon. Not unless the state, Canada, and private investors pony up billions of dollars and Haines builds a sizable port facility. That's the result of a recent $90,000 Haines rail study paid for by the State Department of Transportation. The state contracted with Kels Boland of Prologue Canada to conduct the study, and he presented his findings in Haines recently.
Some amazing developments that are going to take place in Yukon and Alaska, and the question is the logistics. Make it necessary when you're further inland for the economics of these projects. And that's what this is all about. This is the logistics of making project resource development projects actually work in the hinterland.
Boland looked at four industrial rail options that would bring a link to a port in Haines. Such a link would primarily be attractive to Canadian mineral companies to bring their product to Tidewater for export. The first takeaway from the study is any rail link project would be expensive. A route between Haines and Carmack's Yukon would cost $3.6 billion. A Haines to Delta Junction rail connection would cost $3.1 billion. The study concluded neither of these options are economically feasible, although Boland pointed out there were some upsides, such as reduced road maintenance costs.
There is public value, public sector value, from the fact that you would be transferring a whole lot of trucks from a highway system to a railway system.
Another option looked at a rail link to the Alberta oil sands. That's an area in eastern Alberta considered the third largest oil reserve in the world. But getting the product to market has been a challenge. The Alberta government has funded a $2 million study linking the Alberta Railroad to the Alaska Railway and then somehow funneling the oil through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to Valdez. Or it could ship to Haines, but that would require a Valdez-like port in Haines with oil tankers traversing the Lynn Canal. Despite the price tags, the study touts advantages to developing a rail link to Haines. It could save highway truck hauling traffic, have some environmental benefits, create jobs, and stimulate the economy for Haines and other communities. There are also obvious downsides. For one, mineral markets and mining ventures are speculative. Also, a portion of the Haines Railroad would have to get approval to run through the state Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. But that isn't deterring at least some rail supporters in Haines from pursuing the idea. Dave Barry is on the Haines Port Development Council, a private group formed to advocate for the potential of a Haines Port expansion. He found positive notes in the presentation that highlighted mineral development and exploration in the Yukon.
I think it brings to light the potential for development in this part of Alaska and Yukon. And we've always known that there's been mineral deposits, but there's never been an infrastructure to get it to tidewater. And this study emphasizes that there are profitable ways to get the minerals to tidewater, and the tidewater is Haines.
Barry is also one of four men who immediately after the rail study was presented, formed the Haines and Yukon Railway LLC. The group says it will work to bring all stakeholders together to make a rail link to Haines happen. Mayor Stephanie Scott also attended the recent presentation. She said the prospect of a rail link and new port facility is enticing in some ways, but it's also difficult to think so long range when there are more pressing local projects that need funding. She also wonders how the community would ultimately decide to balance commerce with a sense of place if a rail project ever became a reality.
I know that the people of Haines treasure the beauty of this environment and don't want to have that sense of peace and serenity disrupted. Yet I also know that commerce is one of the mechanisms that keeps a community vital and alive, and we have to have commerce here in order to thrive.
The study is still in draft form, but will be released by the Haines Borough and the state when it's finalized. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
A small group of people gathered Saturday in Anchorage to use art to make change. Joanna Urich reports the National Water Dance was an effort to use the art of human movement to generate compassion for the nation's streams, lakes, and oceans.
The stage for the National Water Dance is the web. The virtual audience transcended those physically present. A collaborative project dreamed up by Dale Andre in Florida, this dance flowed across the country from the nation's southeastern tip in Florida to its most northern venue, Ship Creek, still partially frozen in the city of Anchorage, Alaska.
We also loved the juxtaposition of the really beautiful natural element of the water in that creek, with mountains in the distance and trees, but at the same time, the power plant, the city, the commerce.
Catherine Kramer is a friend of Andre and brought the idea of taking part in the national event to Becky Kendall at Alaska's Momentum Dance Collective.
It's this beautiful river that trickles down through this industrial area, but people fish on it in the summer. It's this idea of subsistence that we have here in this very urban environment. I mean, what a interesting way to bring our attention to water and our relationship with it in our city.
The National Water Dance took place in 30 different communities and included 100 different organizations. If Anchorage was typical, the production was a community effort, including everyone from elementary school students to professional dancers, poets, artists, advocates, and anyone who loves rivers, streams, lakes, and oceans. All those involved believe that water is essential to life and that humankind needs to better protect it. Catherine Kramer.
Love, that's the power behind it. It's a love and caring concern for one another and for this planet that we live on that has encouraged people to make a statement about the dilemma that we face and the dire straits we are in. as we look at the health of our water.
In Anchorage Saturday, the weather tested that love. With cold, dank temperatures and a threat of snow, as dancers and musicians took their places at the footbridge over Ship Creek precisely at noon. Unlike the dancers elsewhere who wore leotards and light costumes, our hardy Alaskans were sensibly cuddled in fleece. Saturday's Ship Creek was flowing in and around plenty of ice. Those who attended saw only one view of a much larger performance because from the opening notes, the Ship Creek dancers joined the rest of the nation live streaming their steps through the web. The first 3 minutes of the National Water Dance consisted of all performing the same movements choreographed by Andre in Florida from gestures and movements sent to her previously on the web from those who would be dancing. After the opening, dancers in each venue moved on to perform their own unique choreography. Watching and knowing the water dance was happening somewhere in the virtual world was a reminder of summer hikes along waterways, knowing the water flowed out of sight along a network to the ocean. At the conclusion, all in Anchorage headed inside to listen to writers and musicians and watch some of the live stream material which was already being reconfigured and still spreading.
Those performances will continue to be viewed. Some of the audience still hasn't seen it.
Outside, under a light flurry of spring snow, the gulls reclaimed Ship Creek. Not a raven was in sight, having moved on to their summer homes inland. I'm Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Joanna Urich in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. SalmonLove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
Get away and stay in AK at UAS Juneau. Small enough that your professors know you by name, big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new residence hall opening fall of 2014. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.